The Last Bohemian.
Cleo Silvestre is a woman of many firsts. An actor on stage and screen since the 1950s, she was the first black woman to play a leading role at the National Theatre in London and was one of the first black actors to have a recurring role in a primetime British soap. She was also, as you'll hear in this episode, one of the first black Brits to release a single in 1964, and with none other than her friends, the Rolling Stones. But unlike her peers, Cleo moved through the 60s a little differently, and she never made it quite as massive, even though she starred in some of the definitive British films of that decade, huge TV shows like Doctor Who, and mingled with the movers and shakers of the London scene. The Guardian said that she should have been one of Britain's biggest stars, on a par perhaps with Helen Mirren or Judi Dench. Not that Cleo minds that she's not a household name. Cleo is 76 and still on stage today, whether it's treading the boards or performing under her musical alter ego, Honey Bee Mama. I'm just putting it out there, I would love to see Dana and Cleo singing together at some point. Maybe with your help we can make it happen. If you like what you hear and love what we do, here's just another quick reminder to sign up for our Patreon at patreon.com/thelastbohemians. No doubt you'll want to hear more about Cleo's marvellous life. I was thinking if anybody knows some good vocal warm-ups to get us in the mood, it's you, Cleo.
Vocal warm-ups. Me, 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 me. Ma, 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 ma. I knew that I wanted to be an actor from a very, very early age. I would have said, would say about 5 years old, 4 years old. I used to play with my mother and reenact little scenarios. I was an only child. She was very good. She used to read to me a lot, and I had local friends, but I had to obviously make my own amusement when I was in the house, or our two rooms indeed. I grew up in Drummond Street in Euston in the 50s. It was very, very different then because there weren't many people of colour around, and it was very, very working class. And we had horses, for example. Milkmen used to deliver the milk by horse. Coalmen used to come with horses. So it was a different world. You hardly saw a car. I remember one day a very posh car drove up. It was, I think, a Rolls Royce, chauffeur-driven car, and the woman got out of the car, and she came up to myself and my friend that was I was playing with, and she ran her fingers through my hair, and she said, "Oh, isn't she sweet?" And I knew that she, you know, it was something to be about me being different colour. And then the a chauffeur sort of opened the door and she got back in again. And I remember feeling very, very strange and very, very odd. I had always had a strong sense of being working class because the people that I was brought up with were all working class. I didn't have anybody, people of my colour, to relate to, really, apart from my parents.
I mean, it's hard enough nowadays, still, if you're working class, to break through into the entertainment industry. So what must it have been like in the 50s and 60s?
It was very different in those days because they were drawing room dramas. So you didn't have working class dramas. And it was quite difficult to break through because you had to hope that somebody would employ you, particularly, you know, in my case, I hoped that somebody would recognise that, you know, people like me were around and would employ me. But it was quite a difficult thing. They were usually middle and upper class dramas, Eton, educated people. When I started out, I didn't feel there was a place for me, but I wanted to make a place for me. My school, when I told them I wanted to be an actor, my head teacher, who was formidable, actually a wonderful woman, she said to me, "Cleopatra, there are no parts for coloured actresses in Britain." And in fact, she was totally right, because in those days you would never see black people on telly. But it made me determine that I would, you know, I wanted to do that, and that's what I'd do. I was angry with her at the beginning, but I do realise she had my best interest at heart.
Where did that determination come from?
It's just a gut feeling that you have, and that you feel that you can't survive unless you act. you have to do it. I didn't ever go in for it for the money or the fame. I just went into it because I wanted to act, and I wanted to hopefully make a difference through the plays I was doing.
You must have had to develop an incredibly tough skin. How did you do that?
How did I do that? If you believe in something and you want to do it, you might get rejection, but you think, well, I'm just going to go through another route or try another route. I just knew that I wanted to act. My mother had been a tap dancer, and she was brought up in Yorkshire. She was mixed. We never knew who her father was. Her mother was Yorkshire, white, from Hull, but because her mother rejected her. So she was then fostered, and the authorities deemed that the foster woman was too old to look after my mother. So they put her to another foster mother, and my mother kept on running away to the original foster mother. So eventually they put her in a children's home when she must have been about five, I think. She never knew her mother, because her mother, as I say, abandoned her. But we later found out that her mother, in fact, was a tap dancer. And she was on the music halls. And she went to America after she had my mother and opened a tap dance school in New York. Rumour has it that she taught Ginger Rogers to tap dance.
They both sound like they were incredibly bohemian.
They were. Well, my mother was very, very bohemian. She was amazing. And from coming from that background, being totally rejected and making so much of her life, always interested, always exploring new ideas, teaching herself languages, learning instruments, doing pottery and jewellery. I found out the identity of my real father when I was in my 60s and found that from being an only child, I had at least 15 half-brothers and sisters. So that was quite a shock. They were in Sierra Leone. What happened was, when I was young, I used to get these airmail letters from Sierra Leone, from Uncle Ben. And also I used to get letters from one of his daughters, who used to say, "Your sister Miriam." I never really questioned. I was very young. I was about five or six. I never really questioned it. And I just assumed that that was how everybody, you know, you were uncle, brother, sister, father. So, but I always had an idea that maybe there was more to Uncle Ben than there, you know, appeared. Anyway, I showed my daughters and my son these letters. And one of my daughters was going to Sierra Leone in a show, and she took one of the letters, and within an hour of arriving in Freetown, she'd found a half-sister of mine. So that was quite a shock. And they all knew about me. It's a lot to take on board when you're in your 60s. And it explains a lot, because I'd always felt more of an affinity with Africa than I had with the West Indies. And for example, I adore African music of all sorts, from sort of South African music to palm wine music and Moroccan music. I always felt more of an affinity with Africa than I did with the West Indies. And I suppose finding out that my father was from Sierra Leone, you know, justified that. When I grew up, most people assumed that I was from the West Indies. They weren't used to people who'd been born and brought up in England having, you know, my colour skin. I mean, Windrush happened in, 48? So I was born pre-Windrush. So I was growing up before that Windrush generation started to, you know, procreate.
So are you saying that there's a myth that Black British identity started in the UK with Windrush, when actually there'd been loads of people of colour born in the UK years before that?
Yes, there was a population pre-Windrush, and I think it's important that their stories are remembered. For example, I was lucky enough that All Creatures Great and Small picked up on my mother's story and wrote me in as a character from Yorkshire in the 1930s, which most people would think was probably not viable. But in fact, a lot of my mother's friends were Yorkshire-born mixed race, people that she'd met in the shows, or they were Scottish mixed race or Welsh. So there was a little group of people who were in Britain pre-Windrush. I think people are beginning to wake up to the richness of Black people in the Britain. And I think that they are being shown more on television, particularly. So it's good, and in films as well.
What were your 60s like in London?
My 60s were fantastic. I think because being a post-war baby, we'd play on bomb sites and the whole world was very, very grey post-war. And then suddenly there was this burst of colour, music, you know, performance art and everything. And it was just absolutely wonderful. I discovered blues on a Thursday night at the Marquee. So I used to go down there, and then I met, through going down there, met people like Letts's Corner, Long John Baldry, Mick Jagger, and the rest of the Stones. So it was very exciting.
So were you friends with the Rolling Stones before they were famous?
Yes, definitely. I used to go up to... used to go to Edith Grove. Oh my God. Edith Grove was where Mick, Brian and Keith lived. And it was absolutely, it was something else. It was so messy. I suppose it was typical student rooms, you know. But I remember the first time I went there, I saw all these milk bottles in the hallway, and they had sort of fungus and stuff growing in them. Mick told me, I think, that they were Keith's. I don't know whether he was cultivating something, but anyway, the next time I went, I decided to try and tidy up a bit. So I went there and tried to make some sort of effort to make the place a bit tidier. But I mean, I was particularly friendly with, I suppose, Mick, Brian and Keith. I loved Charlie. He was great, and he had his girlfriend. Bill, I always, seemed to get on with. But it was really the two that I really got on well with was Mick and Brian.
I read somewhere that you were Mick Jagger's first love and you nearly got married. Is that true?
Well, he did ask me to get married. Yeah, he did ask me. Yeah, yeah.
And what did you say?
I thought we were too young, and I knew that they were going to be very big. And I just thought that it wouldn't survive, I suppose, in a way.
This was a time of, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, liberation. Was that your experience of London in the 60s?
It was quite different in a funny way, because obviously there were the drugs around. The sex, I felt, in a way, totally inhibited, because I felt that as a person of colour, I had to represent. So if I was what people thought was easy, then people would judge all black girls as being easy. So I was quite, not prudish, but I was, I wasn't as free as I would have liked to have been. My dress, I was totally outrageous in my dress. I used to make all my own clothes, and yeah, and some of them were quite outrageous. With behaviour, I always felt guarded in a funny way, because I, as I say, I did feel, because, you know, people would judge me as a black person, and so I had to really behave.
That's a really interesting point. You know, you don't get as many outlandish, bohemian, eccentric black people in the UK because of those points that you were saying, because if you were seen as outlandish, it might cause you more trouble than if you were white.
I think it's a valid point, actually. So you felt that you had to set an example because people would judge you, because you were probably the only person like that that they knew. So you had to really behave well so that they couldn't then point a finger and say, aha, we told you. They're all tarts.
I want to talk about your music career. What was the track that you put out?
Oh, God. Years ago, Mick phoned me up one day and said that they were going to the studio and Andrew wanted me to do a recording. I recorded To Know Him Is To Love Him, which is an old Teddy Bears song. And Phil Spector was actually in the studio.
So the Rolling Stones call you up and say, we want you to do this track. What did you think? Did you think this was going to be the start of a, you know, blossoming music career?
No, I just thought, oh, that would be fun to do and go along and do a number with them. I never thought of anything following on from it. I loved singing and enjoyed it, but I then had something quite traumatic had happened. And I then couldn't sing. So I didn't sing.
What was the traumatic thing that happened, Cleo?
It's a bit painful to talk about, but let's just say it was something that had happened when as a child. And it just all came to the surface again. And I just lost my voice. So I didn't really sing for a while, for about 40, 50 years.
Wow, you didn't sing for 40 or 50 years?
No.
But you could act instead?
Mm.
Was that because you felt more comfortable taking on different characters than to be yourself?
Exactly. Taking on different characters was fine, but being yourself was difficult. Even now, when I sing, I don't sing under my name. I have to have an alter ego.
How did you start singing again?
Well, it was just before my 70th birthday, and I've always loved blues music. You know, you always regret the things in life that you don't do. So I thought, well, I've always loved blues music. I've never actually done it. And I don't want to be on my deathbed thinking, I wish I'd done it. So I got together a band. It was absolutely fantastic, very liberating.
Mm. What was your experience of the film industry like, and how did you land your first role?
Oh, the first role I did when I was young, I was 8 or 7 or 8, which was a film called Johnny on the Run. And that was directed by somebody called Lewis Gilbert, who went on to do Educating Rita, Carve Her Name with Pride and everything. And that was a very happy experience. The agent I had sent me up to meet somebody called Ken Loach, who was doing a production at Television Centre. And I was sitting in a corridor and the tea boy came out and ushered me into the room and started talking, and I suddenly realised it was Ken Loach. I thought he was a tea boy because he looked so young and he was so friendly. And that was for Up the Junction, which was amazing production, which really caused a stir. And I was playing a factory girl in that. And he got together a group of actors. Most of us had London accents. We were real people as opposed to the sort of type of people that British television had been used to seeing beforehand. You know, I'm talking about, you know, very sort of upper class, middle class people. These were nitty gritty characters. So then I went on to work in Kathy Come Home, which had caused a great, great stir because it was highlighted the plight of homelessness and authority and shelter started as a result of Kathy Come Home.
So were you aware at the time that you were breaking boundaries?
They were all very political, Ken's plays, and I wanted to be part of that because I sincerely believe that we have to live together and just, you know, oh, sorry, I'm just getting so emotional because I feel that it's difficult. Working class people have been downtrodden for so long and still downtrodden. And I just want to be part of something that makes a better world. And just, I don't know. It's so difficult. It's I've always thought that performing has many different functions. It can entertain, it can educate, and it can enlighten. And occasionally the three things come together. And for me, that's what Ken Loach's work embodies.
I'm right there with you. I mean, where are the Ken Loaches of 2022, you know?
It's changed. I mean, we've had things like Small Axe, which is very powerful. And I think people are far more aware now and trying to make a difference.
I mean, can you see why so many UK actors of colour now go to the US to make their careers?
I can definitely see that. There was a book called Black in the British Frame, and I was interviewed for it, and I spoke specifically about that because there were a whole generation of people just slightly younger than me who wanted to act and were very, very good actors, and they all went over to America, and, you know, some of them did very well. Jo Marcel, who was in Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, Calvin Lockhart.
Did you go over to the States to try and crack America yourself?
I went over to the States with the Young Vic. I was lucky enough to go over there on Broadway and was tempted to stay. That Hollywood scene, not that I necessarily would have cracked it, but it never really appealed to me. I just wanted to be back in England, really, trying to, you know, make a pathway here. It must have been in the 70s, thinking about the whole Hollywood scene and what one would have to probably compromise or in order to achieve any level of fame. I'm thinking about people like Weinstein and things, you know. there was always that element was sort of at the back of my mind. TV roles were mainly nurses or prostitutes. I was in a soap called Crossroads, which was much maligned, but I really won't have a bad word said against my particular character, because that character was introduced at a time just after Enoch Powell had made his Rivers of Blood speech. There was a lot of antagonism, particularly up in Birmingham where it was filmed, and a lot of racial tension. And yet lots of people would come up to me in the street and say, oh, Melanie, you know, I love your character. People who probably, you know, had I not been seen, would have said, oh, you know, these blackies are all the same. So it did do, I feel, some good. And I thought that Reg Watson, who was the producer, it was a very bold move of his to introduce me as a character. And not only that, I was the character, I was the daughter, the adopted daughter of the main person who ran the motel. So it was a double thing.
This was an ITV soap. So this was a prime time television soap watched by millions in 1970.
Yeah.
And you were the first black British woman in a recurring role through this soap. Is that right?
Yes, I was actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Are there any other firsts you want to tell me about, Cleo?
No. Everybody's a first of something. When I first went, I first went to the BBC, and there was panic in the makeup room because they didn't know what to use. They had all this sort of pale pink makeup, and eventually something was found. But I came across an old book, a makeup book, the other day, and it has in it light Egyptian, dark Egyptian, Negro one, Negro two, Jew and Arab as the types of, you know, the different colours. It was a makeup book published by Leishner, who are the big makeup, stage makeup people. Well, it was for people, obviously in reps probably, or West End shows, who were maybe blacking up, which, you know, I mean, it wasn't so long. When I started, people were still blacking up. For example, there was the black and white minstrel show, which was on television. My mother used to switch it off.
You know, looking at what you've been in, what you've starred in, the different spaces that you've performed in, I mean, you could have been a massive star. Why do you think that hasn't been the case?
I think sometimes I'd probably been frightened of things and not taken the leap into that next step, because I felt that I would have to compromise myself or betray myself. I was talking to somebody who's in the music business, who's very, very, I mean, household name, the other week, and he said to me, I've always kept in touch with my roots. I've never forgotten my roots. And that to me is so important. And I wouldn't want to be in a world where I just was going to parties and making small talk all the time. That's not me. You know, I'd much rather be in my garden looking at the birds and with my friends and cooking a meal for them.
What would you be cooking?
Sometimes I like to cook sort of a big sort of feasty type thing like my mum would do. And other times I go very sort of minimalist, not minimalist, but I try and be healthy. So all depends on whether I'm what I call a hypocritarian, because I try not to eat meat, but I do sometimes. Yeah, so.
What's been the sort of, you know, the most triumphant moment of your career so far?
I wrote a monologue about Mary Seacole, and I loved the reaction of the audiences who hadn't known about her. Mary Seacole was a Jamaican-born nurse from Kingston who was a herbalist. Her mother had a boarding house who used to look after the soldiers and sailors in Jamaica. And she learned herbal medicine. And Mary was very pro-British. She came to Britain when she was young. And she loved London. And she was very entrepreneurial. And when the Crimean War broke out, she decided that some of the sailors and soldiers that she'd nursed in Jamaica must be going to the Crimea. And she just wanted to go and help. So she came over to England, tried to enroll as a nurse, but was rejected for various reasons, and ended up making her own way there, and actually was actually in the, you know, forefront. She actually went into the fields, tended the wounded soldiers, whereas Florence Nightingale was in Scutari, sort of far away. And she was really, you know, not celebrated at all. She wasn't during her time, but she was forgotten about until about 20 years or more years ago, till the 80s.
You said about Mary Seacole being celebrated, you know, being her contributions being overlooked. Have you ever felt like that during your career?
No, not really. You know, I just do what I do. I don't feel that I should be celebrated or anything because I haven't really done much.
I don't think that's true, Cleo. You've been in most major British television shows over the years, from Casualty to Doctor Who. You've acted for countless decades.
I don't know, just what I want to do, really. And I'm just lucky that, you know, I've still have a career, even now.
Is there a broader range of roles available?
There are a broader range of roles available, but at the same time, a lot of them, there's also, you know, I've been asked, I think in the last couple of weeks, I've had sort of two plays sent to me, and they are very stereotyped West Indian women. So that does, you know, still go on. But I think things are getting much better. My dream role would be a comedy, and it would be some outrageous biddy, but also with an ulterior motive.
So you basically want to be naughty, Cleo?
Naughty. I want to be naughty. Yeah, I love being naughty.
The Last Bohemians.
That was The Last Bohemians with Cleo Silvest, presented by Kate Hutchinson, produced by me, Antonio Odilami, and with sound design by Hannah Walker-Brown. Check out the photos of Cleo and all of our Bohemians by Laura Kelly on our Instagram page.